ones that they're talking about currently is about always being accessible. You know, cell phones, email, all of this. And that is one of the causes of stress and maybe psychological disorders. So think about that. Are we always accessible? Shit. That works.
Oh, right.
Oh, well. Let me shift it a little bit. So today we're going to be talking about Egypt, Mesopotamia, shamanism a little bit. This is just a start. So remember, this class is naturopathic medicine in historical context. We're looking at the roots. We're looking for threads. We're looking at where medicine came from and how it evolved. So I'm just going to be talking about the history of medicine. And I'm leaving out tons of things. Of course. There's so much. I mean, we could have a course on Egyptian medicine, Mesopotamian medicine. We could go into all of that. But I just want to talk about some terms that you're going to hear when we get to other aspects of medicine later. So here's a that says incantation. Egyptian incantation for snake bites. Flow out poison. Come forth. Go forth onto the ground. Horus will exorcise you. He will punish you. He will spit you out. And we'll talk about incantation in Egyptian medicine. So our clinical pearl today, so I was thinking about what's the clinical pearl today? Since most of Egyptian incantations are about snake bites and scorpion bites, I thought, hey, let's talk about homeopathy or bites, snake bites, and spiders. Again, I'm sorry this is cut off. It's something to do with this. But the slides are all on the portal. Apis. Have you heard of Apis? Apis is a homeopathic, these are all homeopathics. Apis was really Constantine Herring crushed up a bee. I love that. Crush up a bee. It was a live bee at the time. And potentizes it as a homeopathic remedy. And Apis is excellent for bee stings. Now, as we talked about last week or 2 weeks ago with Arnica, there is the sensation of being bruised. Apis, so if somebody gets a bee sting, you can give them Apis. Now that's like, that's exact cures exact, not like cures like, and we'll get to homeopathy in a few weeks. But Apis, if you do have a bee sting, you have to have these characteristics. You have to have itchy, swollen, red, angry, red hives, where the skin is swollen, it's hot, you get restless. You get itchy, and you're thirstless. And think of a bee, a worker bee, not the queen bee, the worker bee. Always busy, always going to do something, always. And that's the idea of Apis. So somebody gets bee stung, they're restless, they don't want to sit still, they're itchy, they're swollen, and they're better cold. Now, you could be stung by a bee. Leaven is another remedy. It's a plant. And it's for puncture wounds. So that could be spider bites or snake bites, or it could be bee bites. They're not really mad at you. The bee just went to bite you. Bee stings. But in this, in contrast to Apis, there's coldness of the area. The body gets cold. Yet there are better cold applications. This is where homeopathy is very specific. So you're cold, but you want cold. And the area could be blue, it could be numb, it could be stiff. It's also great for puncture wounds itself. So if you're, you know, a nail or something, one of my patients who rolled over a rusty nail, and the area got cold and blue, lead him, it's gone. And then lachesis, specifically, lachesis is the bushmaster snake. It's the venom of the bushmaster snake, and it's great for snake bites. Hopefully, you're not going to be bitten by a bushmaster snake anytime soon. But with lachesis, there is this constriction. With lachesis, there's this swelling, and there's this hot, and there is restlessness, and there's loquacity. The person gets really talkative. They don't want to be touched. There's a sense of constriction. You know, you're dying of snake. You get suspicious. Blood can clot. You can have sepsis. I mean, so if you're out in the woods and you get stung by, or bitten by a snake, this is something to think of. And the tongue also darts in and out, too. And if you have the person stick out their tongue, there's a little red tip. Okay. Just things to know. Yes?
So with aphids, it says bee stings, but what about, like, mosquito bites, if you're allergic to mosquitoes and they get that same red, hot, swollen?
Yes. If it's red, hot, and swollen. So any sting could be red, hot, and swollen. But the person would also be thirstless.
Okay.
They'd also be restless. And there'd be intense itch. You can use aphids for mosquito bites.
If someone is allergic to bees and says sweating foxes or something, would aphids
not come? I was stung. My second year, I was stung by something. I don't know. I'm allergic to bee stings and other insect bites. And I had hives, and it was swelling and itching and red. And by the end of so I would usually get epinephrine or something. And then the end of the afternoon, I was like one big giant hive. And I didn't want to do, this was my second year, you know, when you're really passionate. I'm not going to do anything allopathic. I'm not going to take Benadryl. So I went to the clinic. Instead of giving the aphids, they gave me a combo, some kind of bite combo, some kind of insect bite combination. And it kept getting worse, and I was starting to get respiratory stridor at the end of the night. My friend said, I'm not letting you sleep here alone. You're going to go to the hospital. I was like, no, it's going to work. And I kept thinking, aphids was in it. Aphids, ledum, belladonna, there was a number of remedies. And again, this is the difference between the combinations. Combinations have everything in it. So one of those things should work. The next morning, this is what happened. I wound up going to the islands. No, the next morning, everything was gone. So, that wasn't a bee sting, but it was some kind of bite. And again, it doesn't matter with the insect so much. With any of these could be a bee sting. Any of these could be a snake bite. It has to have it has to have the characteristics. So if I get stung by a bee, and I have coldness instead of hot, if I'm thirsty instead of thirstless, then it might be lethal. That's how you think about it. Last question, and just throwing these out, we're going to talk about...
How much do you think do you attribute to time, and how much to the homeopathic remedy in that?
I attribute it to the homeopathic remedy because in time, in past experience, and that's a great question because this is the whole question about Egyptian medicine. You read the text, they say, well, we didn't really know what those herbs were doing, so it must have been the patient's belief. And one of the things that bothers me is we sum up everything as a patient's belief. Yes, I think intention is important. But in the past, if I swelled up with a hive, I wound up in the hospital. So I don't believe that 8 hours later, when there was no mark on me and I couldn't find where, like, I was bitten, I attribute that to the remedy. That, no. I can't tell you for sure. And we're going to read an article, I think it's next week, on the certainty principle. And we're going to talk about this, like, how certain are you? So it fits with this. After the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up, a psychologist at some school said, okay, I'm going to ask everybody in my class, it was over 100 people, write down where were you yesterday when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up. And they wrote it down, and he saved it. 10, 15, and 20 years later, he went back to the people and he said, where were you? And the person said, oh, I was in this class, blah, blah, blah. He said, okay, really? And he handed them the letter. And they said, is this your handwriting? Oh, this is my handwriting, but that's not how it happened. What do you mean? No, it happened this way. So people would argue to their death, that's not what happened. I know that's my handwriting, but, you know, that's not how it happened. I remember it this way. So we remember certain things certain ways. We say that we feel certain about things. And is that gut impulse? And we'll argue over this is how it happens. This is why we know, like, when you watch an accident. And you go to court 3 years later, and it's isn't that really how it happened? Fits with this. Fits with my story. I'm certain it was the remedy. Well, I'm not really certain it's the remedy. I know it's happened before. When we make medical decisions, how certain are we about things? So this is something to think about. And this is also why documentation is really important for medical charts. Sometimes because then you can say, this is what happened when this happened. It doesn't necessarily mean it's true. Okay. So actually, in 2330 BCE, you see there was already. Okay. I don't know why I did that. There were already in the tombs of the pharaohs. They were already talking about reflexology. So there are some ideas about reflexology happening. I just put that picture up there. I just want to see if it's going to change by itself. So what I have here right now, you do not have to remember this. What I'm going to have is go through Egyptian history, and I'm just going to talk about different stages. It's going to go fast. You do not have to remember it. I'm just trying to talk about different periods of what we see in the different areas and what the population was like. You don't even have to remember all of this, but there, if you look through time, you see what started to happen, what's happening. There were flint dental drills back in 8,000 BCE. Settlements happened before people were hunters and gatherers and moved around. Then in around here, you start to see settlements develop. Then you see agriculture starting to develop. And barley and emmer, so very close cousins of wheat, wheat wasn't cultivated yet until periods later. But then you see the development of pottery, and in pottery there's art, and a lot of it was talked about for healing as well. You also see copper and flint work in the fourth millennium. Then we get into the dynasty periods. There were three first early dynasties, but in the around 3100, 2686. You know that the Iceman that was found, that was wrapped up? He was wrapped up with 8 medicinal herbs, and there were tattoos on him indicative of acupuncture points and acupuncture lines. So it was acupuncture used, but the herbs were used medicinally. How did we know what those herbs were? Did they work? That's what we're going to talk about. There's other dynasties where writing developed. In the second dynasty, bronze developed. Third dynasty, the first recorded doctor. In Hotep, we'll talk about in Hotep in a moment. Just looking at what's happening. The pyramids happened around the third to sixth dynasty. So 2686, that's what I'm talking about. 2686, there was a problem. The population in Egypt was around 1.5 million. Pyramids were developed. We see the hieroglyphs starting around this time. And I'm going to skip all of these right here. They're there for you. But what we see, I do want to say in the Middle Kingdom, we start to see the medical papyri. We'll talk about that in a minute. I'm just skipping. But by the end of the New Kingdom, the 18th to 20th dynasty, the population doubled, almost tripled, 3 million to 4 million by the end, around 1069. Okay, so medical papyrus. So let's start talking about this. So, Clement of Alexandria. We'll talk about Alexandria. So in the Greek, this is the next phase. Quote some of the Egyptian books, and there were 42 books on human knowledge, and 6 of those books talked about medicine. They talked about the structures of the body. They talked about diseases, the instruments of doctors, what they used, remedies, eyes and their diseases, and diseases of women. And so they're quoting this, and the reason is, this all makes sense, right? The Edwin Smith Papyrus is one of the oldest medical texts, and it's one of the almost all intact, and it's in certain museums. I have them listed here. That's in New York, and it dates around 1550 BCE. And so here's a list of many of the major papyri. And again, you can see what they say. So Edwin Smith talks about surgicals and surgical treatments, treatments for medical diseases. The Evers talks about medical conditions. The other ones talk about gynecological conditions, rectal disease. And the London Papyrus is all about magical incantations, and we'll talk about that in a second, too. So there's just a number of Egyptian papyruses that look around the times. 1550, 1700 BCE, 1312, this gets newer. Okay, so what do we know about medicine in Egypt? Anatomy. And this is going to be a theme we see in medicine when we get to Tibetan medicine, when we get to Unani and Ayurveda. In anatomy, there's no real remaining works that talk about anatomy. There's no evidence that they did dissection. However, certain Greek physicians talk about the, make reference to it, like they'll talk about Galen and Celsus, and they make reference to dissection, but there's no evidence that there was actually dissection done. And what's also interesting is the anatomical names of bones were only given to a few. And basically it was to bones of the skull, the lower jaw, the vertebra, the ribs, and the clavicles. Everything else was just talked about as bones, as far as we know.
There could be books that are missing.
Now, the question, how do we know? How do we make decisions? What is this? Because we're going to talk about this with medicine in Egypt. Trauma was one of the most empirical forms of medicine because you could see what happened. The Edmund Smith Papyrus talks about splintered fractures and surgical operations. And if you see some of the remains of the surgical procedures, and geez, I wouldn't want surgery back then. They're talking about everything from hydroceles, inflammation of the scrotum, removal of tumors, setting skulls, removing teeth, removing parts of the skull in trauma. So trauma, the causation was really obvious and the treatment followed it was mostly surgery. Wall paintings in the tombs show minor industrial injuries. So when you're building, people falling, bones being crushed, being kicked by animals. So in medicine, that was very empirical. This is what happened, this is what you did. But that's just in trauma. All the other medical disorders, from tumors, gynecological problems, illnesses, parasitic infections, the main cause of disease in Egypt, parasites, the main cause of death, parasitic infections and malnutrition. Most of it was empirical, speculative, mostly magical. And there was little distinction between religion and magic. So what was the cause? You have seizures, classic one. It was the gods. You get the flu, it was the gods. The main bacterial and viral infections were leprosy. Leprosy was the big one. There's a number of others. But some respiratory disorders. But it was all magical illness, the magical causes. And the main thing is you maligned the deities, and the demons caused your disease. So what I find interesting, and it goes back to the question, is in reading texts about Egyptian medicine, when these prayers to the gods worked, they said, well, it must be because you think that. But they also point out, what is the cost, the risk, the discomfort, and pain of medical treatments? And the uncertainty of the outcome. So the main treatments, we'll talk about what they used, they were really risky. Some of the herbs, they still didn't know what they did. And could people afford these? So when people got better from using incantations and the other things, was it a placebo? Was it faith? Was it expectation? How do you know? This is what I want you to start thinking about. So I do want to briefly talk about the body and the soul, because it's interesting when we get to spirituality and medicine, the evolution of the term soul. When we talk about soul, how we talk about it and define it, and how we define spirituality is not the same as it was even in the Bible.
So, kind of going back to the last one and off of that, what's the difference between magic and religion in this sense?
In this sense, none.
Okay.
And we're going to get to this. So, in Egypt, in the Old Kingdom, and then you see the evolution in time. In the Old Kingdom, I don't know how to pronounce any of these things. That's the word, XT.
Anybody speak Old Egyptian?
It's the body before death, the physical body. And Gnum, who was the great sculptor, created this body, this child infant body, mixed it with some sperm, to talk about that, and then implanted it in. the womb of a woman. So the great sculptor was the person who created this body. And any of the diseases that happened in the Old Kingdom were really because of spiritual and demonic forces entering or surrounding the body. So then we have another form of body, which is the Sa, which was the mummified body. Originally, as you know, you may have heard that originally it was just pharaohs, kings that were mummified, and then later through time, other people wanted that practice too, because the afterlife, how your body was preserved, that's how it's going to walk around. And when you died, the mummified body went to the gods of the underworld, and there was a ceremony of the opening of the mouth where your soul, and we'll get to this, was measured against a feather. That's the next slide. But if you didn't pass the ceremony, your body was devoured for eternity. So this mummified body was this place where the soul was stored. It's immortal, yet it's in the same form. It looks the same to your regular body. This is why you want to be mummified and preserved. Come on. So it's interesting here, the different aspects of it. The heart in Egyptian medicine was part of the essence, who you were. It's the seat of your mind, emotions, intelligence, and your moral sense. If you were a very moral person, it's because of your heart. It gave you your purpose in life. And after death, your heart essence goes to Anubis for mortality, and it's, if you were bad, and this is where it's measured against the feather, bad people, immoral people, are heavier than the feather. A feather, a heart. No one ever sees this happen. And if not, you were devoured by the monsters. And then it ends the person's existence. So what did people do? They put a heart scarab. And they wore it as an amulet to protect the evil spirits from entering their heart and becoming immoral, very emotional. Then you have your name. And this is really interesting. So this speaks to all the spiritual beliefs and the magical thinking that was going on at the time. Your name, some of the gods' names were never mentioned, because even known to the other gods, because once you speak a name, it can cause and evoke problems. So it's the foundation of the individual. So many people would wear their name on wristbands around the border of their neck. Existence comes with having a name, even though your parents might not know it. So when you're born, you have the body, you have this heart essence, and you also have your name. So there was power in this. So knowing someone's name, speaking someone's name, could cause illness. Also, when you die, and if your body is buried and mummified in the tube, they inscribe the name over there. If someone scratches that out, not only could cause illness for the person who scratched out the name, but it will destroy the soul of the person whose name you scratched out. Obliterating the name is the same thing, scratching it out. And the cartouche is this magical rope inscribed with your name to protect yourself so that no one can destroy your name. So all of this about your name. Yes? Well, the belief is you come in with a name. Your parents will give you a name, but that's not your real name. And so some of the seers and some of the magicians and the healers will tell you what your real name is. Now, this is the part that I think is interesting, because first principle of naturopathic medicine, vis medicatrix naturae, the healing power of nature, the life force. So we've talked about these other aspects of the soul, but here's one of the first places you see this, is the ka, or the hamset, the female perspective, is the life force. It's the difference between life and death. It stays with your body after death, and it came into being when your body was birthed, and it's immortal as long as it's nourished, though. So the soul, the ka, doesn't have to be directly fed, but there are food offerings given to it. And when you die, your ka rejoins all the souls. So the ka is the food offerings. And so in Egyptian paintings, what you'll see is there's often a second figure. It kind of looks like a twin right behind the person. That's the person's ka, or the hamaset. So here's where we talk about this. If you don't have this, all the other things are not important. Then you have your shadow. And that's often depicted as this pitch black image. And this belongs to the world of souls, and sometimes it symbolizes a small figure painted all black. You'll see a small figure. It moves independently. Your soul can move into this other form of shadow, can move independently from your body, but it always returns. And after death, it has to go to the underworld. So there's all these ways you have to be challenged, and there's all these perils you have to go through to see if you will survive into the next life. And the afterlife is just like this life, but it's on a different plane. And you want to go there. So after your death, your shadow has to go through like the devourer of shadows, and if you don't pass that, then your whole existence will be gone. But the point I'm saying is that all these different things can obliterate the whole person. So if the shadow doesn't survive, your whole being is gone. If your heart essence doesn't survive, your whole being can be gone. If somebody destroys your name, your whole being can be gone. And then we have the shining one, the spirit, the Ankh. Later traditions say that when you die, the Ankh goes up and becomes a star. Ordinary mortals couldn't ascend before the Old Kingdom, then they could. It's called your spirit and after death, you're considered to join the panoply of souls. All of them are hanging out in the heavens. It's unchanged, and this is part of what leads to reincarnation. This spirit will reincarnate. And then there's the concept of the Ba, which is said to be the shapeshifter. So many people can travel. It's often symbolized. Did you see that symbol of the bird with the human head on top? Have you seen that over the pyramids? This is the only part that lives on after death, separate of your soul. It can travel, but returns to the body. It can shift into different animals. It's considered your psyche or personality. So where your heart is, your emotions and your purpose in life, this is the part that Jung would talk about as your personality. Okay. So magic in medicine. Except for traumas, where individuals are, where you see that there's mostly surgical procedures, the main form of medicine was through praying to the deities. And Isis is considered one of the nine deities. And people would pray to her to ward off the damage of other things happening before they even happen. And if the influences, the gods were malign, you pray to Isis to ward them off. Part of praying to the gods is also using remedies. And so here's another interesting thing about harvesting plants. The Egyptians had this method of harvesting certain plants due to the diurnal variation during the time of day. And that certain herbs were more potent during certain times of day, if you harvested in the morning or if you harvested in the evening. Interestingly, they never talked about what was the cause of that. They just said in the old papyri that we see today, they said it was because of the gods. Galen started talking about the components of it. This is in Greek medicine, hundreds of years later. Like, for instance, morphine. We know that the alkaloid content is more potent at certain times of day than it is in the other times of day. So my question to you is, it was considered a magical practice. We do this based on the gods telling us what to do. But there's some scientific reason behind that. Where did that come from? Was it useful? Now, so what we do is when we look at the practices of medicine, we see that this is what people were doing, this is how they used the herbs, and then we do research and say, oh, wow, there's scientific evidence for it. But I'm wondering, what does this mean about the gods talking to us? Do we get information from them? Or are we going to say, okay, that's just a bunch of craziness? What you also see in early Egyptian herbal medicine is the doctrine of signature. So when a plant was used, not only was it harvested due to some diurnal variation that was intuited by the gods, doctrine of signatures is something you'll learn when we get to Paracelsus, when we get to homeopathy. Who knows what doctrine of signatures is?
I think it states that the you can recognize the use of the plant or what it looks like.
Yes. You said more?
Physical characteristics.
So how a plant looked, where it grew. Originally, in Egyptian medicine, when they started talking about the doctrine of signatures, is when a plant looked like a specific organ. Most of the plants were used for organs that looked similar to it.
Aren't there quite a few errors in that book, though?
Aren't there?
Quite a few errors.
Oh, there's many errors, or many things we would not agree with. But when we get to Paracelsus, and then we get to homeopathy, we're going to talk about part of the point of Doctrine of Signatures, because there's some errors, but there's also some amazing similarities. So this is where you see this. So one of the principles we'll talk about in herbal medicine, when you get to your herbal medicine class, is the Doctrine of Signatures. We see this all the way back in Egypt. So I'm just trying to talk about where some of these things came from. Another thing that happens in Egypt is you see evidence, first of all, for the women. You see evidence of women healers. There's a text called the Lady Director of Lady Physicians. And it lists the Lady Physicians. Who's the director of the Lady Physicians? That's the translation. So when we talk about medicine and women in medicine. But in the Old Kingdom, around 2686, we see evidence from the papyri. We see evidence of a profession of physicians forming, that there is a specific profession. Herodotus, in the 5th century in Greek medicine, goes back to Egypt and says, the art of healing is with... I should be able to read the whole thing, right? Since it's cut off. Yes. The art of healing is with them divided up, so that each physician treats one ailment and no more. Egypt is full of physicians, some treating diseases of the eye, others the head, others the teeth, others the stomach, and others unspecified diseases. So we have this argument in modern medicine now that, you know, you have a physician who only treats the anterior triangle of the neck. There's some case about that. And you specialize in one area. In Egypt, people did specialize in one area of the body. So you see the specialization that happens, and there's a hierarchy. And you see this already. There's the chief physician, the master of physicians, the director of physicians, the inspector of physicians, the plain physician, and the bandage personnel. And then it gets down to the little task.
What about diseases that affect your whole body or many systems?
Ah. Well, what's the cause of that?
Oh, they think it's the gods.
It's the gods. So this is where we get to the next part of Egyptian medicine. So if it affects the whole body, somebody would say you go to this person and go to this person, but there is also another aspect to that. But the main thing that we see in Egypt is surgery is the mainstay of medicine. Surgery is the main thing. Then there's massage and manipulation. Then we get to remedies, botanical, mineral, and animal. They would use animals for remedies. And this is where we get to alchemy, chemistry. I think the black linen, that was the ancient name for Egypt. So alchemy, what's alchemy? You know the term alchemy?
Is it making gold out of metal?
Gold out of
lead.
So it's about the transformation. So there's a spiritual aspect to that. And gold was often used as a remedy. But alchemy was this part of transforming matter into a different form of matter and using that to treat people. So they would do that with mechanical and mineral and animal remedies. But in the medical papyri, we see that there's diagnosis that was based on interrogation, inspection, palpation, and percussion. Up until then, they didn't list how you look at the patients. They would look at the pulse. They would inspect the urine for smell and for taste. And they would do orthopedic and physical tests. And it's all in there. So this was happening a long time ago. Once you had surgery, massage, and manipulation didn't work, and you weren't going to get remedies, many times the first thing, and this is where we're going to get into Western hydrotherapy and other hygiene treatments, is the sanatoria and incubation. The sanatoria were medical spas, but basically what you would do is do hydrotherapy. There would be a pool. Now, we're going to get to Greek medicine, and Asclepius, temples of Asclepius, had some of these same things. But in hydrotherapy, people would go into pools or rivers where there were statues of the deities that the water ran over. So it was blessed water, and then they would soak in those. Interestingly, one of the treatments for mercury lead poisoning was being in a tepid bath. And modern research shows room temperature, body temperature bath, soaking in there for about 8 hours. In these sanatoriums, people didn't stay here. They would just go and visit. Many of them were also built near riverbeds because river and flowing water was also considered to be healing. But in modern, there are some research studies done in modern hydrotherapy centers of lead poisoning and mercury poisoning using body temperature baths. So the Egyptians did that again from divine intervention without any research. But there was a lot of hydrotherapy and rest. The incubation was sleep pods. They also had, which I think Bastier should have, sleep pods where you would go and sleep and your dreams would be interpreted. Because from the dreams you'd find out which gods are harming you or who is harming you. Not to mention, I mean, just think about it. If you're not feeling well, wouldn't it be great to take a bath and then sleep? And of course, there was the incantation, the prayers to the deities. Many people would wear these amulets, and these amulets were to the gods, often containing some of the botanical substances to help heal the person. But what's important about this is that we see hydrotherapy being used early on. Hydrotherapy stays at the beginning of nature here. So, you were talking about those different doctors. Well, if it affected the whole body and it was the gods that were causing the problem, there was the difference in the magicians. We had this, interestingly, there was a conventional doctor, so that's the term for the conventional doctor, I can't pronounce any of these, who would often refer to the saw or the magician. And it also meant amulet. So the magicians would always give you an amulet with an incantation. And then there's just a few different priests I've listed and a few different gods that you could pray to if you get, you know, want to. If you want to bring pestilence down on your enemy's house, there's certain gods to pray to. The reason I have Imhotep here is Imhotep in the 5th century, a 5th dynasty, was considered the doctor of doctors. Imhotep, when we get to Greek medicine, they talk about Imhotep taking the form of Asclepius. Have people heard of Asclepius? We're going to talk about Asclepius next week. The temples of Asclepius. Imhotep is considered the doctor, the main doctor of Egypt. He was also the architect of many of the pyramids. So, you know, in your spare time, you can be an architect.
We also have two rats,
thank you. Can you pronounce all of these then for me? Okay. So, Egypt. That was Egypt. And if you look at the history, you can see then Babylonian medicine's coming, and you can see when Persia invaded and Assyria invaded and all these things that happened. But Egypt is our basic part. The point I want to talk about with Egypt medicine is that we see hydrotherapy, we see doctrine of signatures, we see incantations. We see that medicine is split. Surgery or physical trauma tends to be more empirical, and regular medical conditions are considered due to gods and magical. That's the thing to just remember. That's the take-home part of that. Then we develop and go into Babylonian medicine. So then Egypt falls and Babylonia starts to rise, and we find another treatise, the Treatise of Medical Diagnosis and Prognoses by... by Excel and King Godley. And this is actually some people, in some of the readings I found, some people attribute to him to sort of be like modern Moses, where the gods handed him these 40 tablets that were about how to live, but it's also about the idea of diagnosis, prognosis, physical exam, and treatment. Other papyri didn't talk about prognosis. They didn't know what the prognosis of certain illnesses were, and now you begin to see this. This is where you start to see more logical thinking. And this is where you first see that you can determine the disease, the etiology, and prognosis from physical exam. So this is one of the things where you start, in Babylonian medicine, you start to see more physical exam happening. And he lists in these tablets medical diseases by etiology, and also said if you look at a combination of people's symptoms, you can determine the disease. So this is a shift away from magical thinking. That's the point. There's beginning to be a shift away from magical thinking, and all these sections are organized from head to toe, discussing everything, and there's separate sections on convulsive disorders, gynecological disorders, and pediatrics. The main treatments they are beginning to use are bandages, creams, and pills, so things are starting to be taken up as pills rather than whole herbs. And when that failed, then exorcism was the next round. And believed that you were filled with the evil spirits and that death had to be removed from you. Interestingly, when they look at some of the bandages and creams, the herbs they use are antiseptic and antibacterial. And so they just say, put the, without knowing that, and they put the cream, and they're saying that many of the reasons people survived, this is one theory that I've read in regarding Babylonian medicine, one of the reasons people improved and lived longer is in order to bandage people's wounds and ailments, they washed them first. And then they put in herbs that had antiseptic and antibacterial qualities. So the thought is now that they're using that and there's the idea of washing, that helped make people's life expectancy go long. Probably. So whereas we had doctors and we had magicians, now we still see these roles. We see, and again, you'll tell me the pronunciation later, in Babylonian medicine, you see the sorcerer or witch doctor, whose role, though, was to diagnose the illness. So this is interesting. We have all these things about the different ways to diagnose and treat diseases, but you go to the witch doctor first, who will diagnose it, determine if it's God or a demon causing an illness, if it was a disease as a result of an error or a sin that you did, and then they would prescribe charms and spells to drive out the spirits. If it's not that, then they would send you to an asu, who's an herbal medical specialist. And they refer in those books to those doctors as physicians. So isn't it interesting that now, if it's a, how do we approach those things? So first you have to go to the witch doctor, then you go to the herbalist. Oh, yes, and some of the plant material they used created this resin, which with alkali, which when heated became a soap, so that also cleaned out the wounds. The last part I want to talk about, again, is code of medicine, the Code of Hammurabi. The king in 1760 wrote the Code of Hammurabi and talked about, this is where you see not just the profession of medicine, but you start to see a code for physicians. And the physician, if you died under the physician's knife, the physician was liable. And compensation and liability were determined based on the status of the patient. So if I treat a king and he gets better, then I'll get paid more because he's a king. If I treat just a normal person, a beggar, or if I actually treat a slave or a servant, and they get better, they don't have to pay me much. But also, what's interesting is if I treat, through surgery, the king, and he dies, then my hand will be cut off. But if I treat a servant under the knife, and they die, I just have to pay the people for the price of the servant. That makes sense, right? 10 shekels for a gentleman, 5 for a poor man, 2 for a servant, if they could pay, or I pay the cost of the servant.
But who wants to be doctors?
Who wants to be doctors? Well, maybe it's not who wants to be doctors. Who wants to be surgeons who treat? Just treat the poor. We also see now healing temples that arrive, and these healing temples are also places where the diagnosis happens. So it's kind of like we're starting to see this area develop of what we might say hospitals. Place of diagnosis and libraries were in the temples, but the treatment often took place in homes. And I said earlier that the rivers were also a site of treatment. The botanical tests that come up, you see most of them have antibacterial and antiseptic properties, and there were 4 tablets that survived about the surgical procedures. Interestingly, the Babylonians had a pregnancy test. They had this, almost a tampon, soaked in herbs that they would insert in the woman, and infuse, and 2 days later, they could determine, based on the pH and the color change, whether a woman was pregnant. They stole some of that process from the Egyptians, but they're the first to really recite pregnancy tests with the herbs. And, wow, if they had patented, where would they be today? also part of Hammurabi's code is that the doctors are required to treat the people on the sidewalk. You're required. So again, who wants to be a doctor? Somebody's not sick on the sidewalk. It's your ethical code. This is what the code of Hammurabi did. Talk about all of these laws that brought order to the area. Treat the people on the sidewalk. The other reason that they suggest people got better, we'll talk about this with Greece, is there was starting to be a public sewage disposal. So is it medicine that helped heal? Is it herbs that helped heal? Was it prayer that helped heal? Or is it a lot of the changes that were happening? I think that...
We were going to talk about shamanism.
But the point. What worked? How do we know? Some of the treatments were claimed to be from divine intervention. If it was and it worked, does that give validity to divine intervention? What does that make you think about people who are claiming to get that information? Other things to say is that the profession of healing became a profession in Egypt and in Babylonia. Physical traumas were basically more empirical, but the anatomy was still not mentioned. Most medical conditions in both forms of medicine were treated with prayer and magic. We also see the idea of the vital force, the thing that when it's not there, you're just dead. There's the doctor's signatures, which we're going to come back to. But also, we see the healing power of prayer, hygiene, and hydrotherapy that are part of these forms of medicine. So when we talk about the roots of naturopathic medicine, we can go way back. We're going to stop. What we're going to do, last one. You're going to meet in your individual lab sections. So what we're going to talk about is beliefs and personal healing rituals. I'm going to ask you to talk about what your personal healing rituals are. What are your beliefs and how do you believe? What do you think about belief in healing? I also want to make an announcement that the naturopathic gathering is happening at Southwest College this year, November 14th through 16th, and you can find that on the website. And we'll talk more about the naturopathic gathering in the lab section.